stars had emerged, including George Soros, Michael Steinhardt, Paul Tudor Jones II, and Julian Robertson. Despite his initial reluctance, Schwartzman signed off on Batten's suggestion, and Batten proceeded to set up a fund of funds, taking stakes with six managers, the most illustrious being Robertson. But Schwartzman, who had never been a trader, was jittery as ever about losses and kept a sharp eye trained on the monthly results. The first month the funds were up 3%, and Steve was happy, recalls Batten. The second month they were up 4%, and Steve was even happier. But around the fourth month, Robertson posted a 4% loss, and Schwartzman was beside himself. "How could this happen?" he fumed to Batten. "Fire him. Fire Robertson." Batten answered by pointing out that Robertson was up substantially since Blackstone first placed money with him. Hedge fund's results, he explained, are inherently volatile, and one bad month does not necessarily a bad year make. Robertson wasn't fired. Over the years, despite occasional setbacks, the fund of funds generated remarkably sturdy returns, and Blackstone later opened it up to outside investors, drawing in tens of billions of dollars, which created an important new source of fee income for the firm. The buyout business remained at the core, but it was still a source of headaches, notwithstanding the reforms Schwartzman had put in place in the wake of the Edgecombe fiasco. Blackstone's first major leveraged purchase of the 1990s and its first foray into distressed investing, Hospitality Franchise Systems, very nearly self-destructed as quickly as Edgecombe had. Henry Silverman, who steered the HFS deal for Blackstone, was versed in the hotel franchise business from his years working for the financier and corporate raider Saul Steinberg, for whom he had led a successful LBO of the Days Inn of America chain. Steinberg was one of the early raiders, having wrested control of Reliance Insurance Group via a hostile tender offer in 1968, when he was just 29, and following that the next year with an implausible and fruitless bid to buy Chemical Bank. In the 80s, Steinberg and Reliance became stalwarts in Drexel's troop of marauders. For a six-year stretch in that period, Silverman led Steinberg's LBO fund, which did mostly friendly deals, including Days Inn. Later, Steinberg would be linked to Blackstone in another way. When his financial empire crumbled in 2000, he was forced to sell many personal possessions, including his sumptuous duplex apartment at 740 Park Avenue. The apartment's buyer, who paid a reported $30 million, was Steve Schwartzman. HFS was set up to take advantage of the financial ills of Prime Motor Inns, one of the world's largest operators and franchisers of mid-priced hotels and motels. In 1990, Prime ran into trouble and needed to dump properties to pay down debt, and Silverman leaped at the chance to get control of Prime's two most prized possessions, the Howard Johnson franchise operation and an exclusive license to run the Ramada franchise. While the hotel business is cyclical, ebbing and spiking with the season and the economy, franchise fees are only partly tied to hotel earnings and are relatively steady, so it looked like a safe bet for an LBO. Moreover, Blackstone was buying in at a reasonable price, $195 million, or 6x cash flow. A month to the day after the buyout closed, however, on August 2, 1990, Iraq invaded Kuwait, an event that wasn't in any of Blackstone's investment scenarios. Almost immediately, as it became clear that the United States would lead a war to drive back Saddam Hussein's army, oil prices shot up and hotel bookings plummeted as people were daunted by the costs and risks of travel. "Our reservation volume fell off a cliff," Silverman says. "It was down 30% to 40% in one day." This quickly threatened to sink the investment, The problem was that HFS didn't actually own the Ramada name. It simply licensed it from one of Hong Kong's biggest property conglomerates, New World Development, and New World, in turn, had the right to withdraw the license if HFS fell behind on its royalty payments, which HFS quickly did. Losing the right to the Ramada name would have rendered HFS largely worthless. At that stage in Blackstone's history, another failure could have threatened not just HFS, but Blackstone itself. Blackstone already had had issues with Wicks and Edgecombe when I got there, Silverman says. The fund was too new for Blackstone's limited partners to start screaming, but they were very concerned. If this deal had blown up, it probably would have been the end of the fund, and maybe the end of Blackstone. Silverman and Schwartzman tried to win some breathing room from New World. After an exchange of faxes with New World Managing Director Henry Cheng, whose father had founded the business, Schwartzman and Silverman flew to Hong Kong in September to see if a face-to-face meeting could prevent the situation from deteriorating. Cheng started off by asking why he shouldn't rescind the license. Schwartzman countered by offering to give New World a higher percentage of HFS's income, a proposal he and Silverman already had made in a fax. "There must be some arrangement we can come to," Schwartzman said. Dissatisfied with the offer, Cheng told them, "Okay, why don't you go and figure out whether there's anything that might be of interest to me?" He then dispatched the two Americans to a nearby conference room with a gargantuan tropical fish tank to draft a proposal. Schwartzman and Silverman pondered the fish and their predicament, eventually formulating what they thought might be a workable compromise. When they returned to Chang's office, however, he dismissed it as unacceptable. "Try to come up with something better," he told them, and they returned to the conference room. Their second suggestion, offered a few minutes later, didn't win over Cheng either. It was now a quarter to noon, and Cheng told them he would be leaving soon. "I'm going to play golf at 12. If we can't work out some arrangement by then, we're just going to take the company." Back to the conference room they trudged. Schwartzman stared glumly at the brilliantly colored fish gliding through the water, thinking, "Here's my whole career about to disappear, like those fish bubbles." With only minutes to go, Schwartzman and Silverman returned and offered yet another revised proposal. This time, Cheng swiftly endorsed it. Before heading to the links, Cheng revealed that he'd been toying with them. "You know, I never would have taken the company, because I had heard that Henry Silverman is a very good operator, and the U.S. is quite far away," Schwartzman recalls him saying. "I really was very pleased you bought this. Thank you for your proposal." Schwartzman was so relieved, he didn't mind the ruse. Though HFS was a problem, Blackstone's other early holdings, Collins and Aikman, CNW, Transtar, and a small investment in a chemical company, weathered the recession without crises. There was still no way to get financing for major new LBOs, but when the company showed signs of improving in late 1992, the IPO market began to pick up, and Blackstone had a chance to show just how well its investments were doing by taking some companies it owned public. In an IPO, typically big stockholders like Blackstone sell at most a small portion of their shares. The market often can't absorb all the stock of a company at one time, and investors will balk if they think existing investors want to cut and run. In many cases, the existing shareholders sell no shares, and the IPO consists solely of shares newly issued by the company, equivalent to, say, a 15 or 20 or 25% stake. While the new stock waters down existing investors' stakes, The IPO raises new capital for the business and establishes a public market value for the stock, opening an avenue for the company's backers to sell their shares and lock up profits later. CNW was the first of Blackstone's companies to undergo an IPO. In April 1992, the railroad sold a 22% stake to the public. The IPO price equated to 12.3 times CNW's cash flow, compared with the 7.2 times Blackstone had paid, and put CNW's overall worth at $3.2 billion, twice the LBO's original $1.6 billion price tag. The plum valuation partly reflected a 20% rise in CNW's cash flows, but more than anything it attested to the IPO market's ravenous appetite for new issues. CNW didn't hit one of its earnings targets. Our operating projections were wrong, but our view of the overall value was right, says Howard Lipson. Blackstone, which sold the last of its CNW shares in August 1993, wound up with a profit of 217% on its original $75 million investment and a gross annual return of 34.2%. Amazingly, it was HFS that yielded the firm's second IPO bonanza. A year after Schwarzman and Silverman's gut-churning negotiation with Henry Chang in Hong Kong, they had expanded HFS by buying another franchisor out of bankruptcy, Days Inn of America. Silverman's old boss, Saul Steinberg, had once owned Days Inn, and in 1989 Silverman had arranged the sale of the chain for $765 million to Tolman Hundley Hotels, one of Days Inn's largest franchisees. The price was stratospheric, 14 times Days Inn's cash flow. Silverman and Steinberg were happy to take the money, but Silverman thought the price was excessive and was convinced that Days Inn was bound to go bust. When Henry joined us, he told us one thing we'd probably be able to do is buy Days Inn, Schwarzman says. He said, I don't know why somebody paid 14 times cash flow for it, but they'll never be able to meet their debt costs because these businesses don't grow fast enough to outrun them. As Silverman predicted, Days Inn filed for bankruptcy in September 1991, allowing Blackstone to grab it for $259 million, one-third the price Silverman had sold it for in 1989. Since HFS already had its franchising infrastructure set, there were huge cost savings to be gleaned from the merger. Most of the same staff that managed the Howard Johnson and Ramada franchises could readily handle Days Inn, too, and most of the Days Inn staff would be pink-slipped. A similar rationale would propel bank mergers later that decade: combined deposits and slash people, as well as thousands of corporate mergers driven by what CEOs euphemistically call cost synergies. It was capitalism with a chilly heart. From a stockholder's standpoint, it also made HFS a far more valuable business with more staying power. Because of the people we already had in place, I thought we'd be adding $50 million of revenue at virtually no cost, Silverman says. In December 1992, with the Persian Gulf War over and travel and hotel bookings back to pre-war levels, HFS went public at $16 a share, 255% above Blackstone's investment cost of $4.50 a share. The shares jumped 17% the first day they traded and soared to $50 within a year. Blackstone exited HFS with a $362 million profit on its $121 million outlay, posting an annual gross return of 59.2%. Almost battered into extinction in 1990, Blackstone had picked itself up off the canvas and was banging out gain after gain. In December 1993, on the strength of its performance in CNW and HFS, together with a smaller profit on a corporate partnership investment with Time Warner in Six Flags theme parks, Blackstone raised a new $1.3 billion buyout fund, nearly twice the amount it had raised in 1987. Rounding up pledges wasn't easy, though. By then, Japan's markets and economy were stalling after a decade-long bubble in stock and real estate prices. The Japanese banks that had thrived in the boom years were now stuck with bad loans and assets that were shrinking in value, and they were retrenching on every front. Most every Japanese financial institution that had participated in Blackstone's first fund, with the exception of Nikko, took a pass on the second. But Blackstone filled the void, and then some, with money from new investors, including several state pension funds, which increasingly were adding buyout funds to their mix of investments. The new fund propelled Blackstone past Clayton, Dubilier, and Rice into the number three slot among independent operators in the buyout game's capital hierarchy. Only the perennial kingpins, KKR and Forstmann Little, were larger. Chapter 10. The Divorces and a Battle of the Minds. If Peterson and Schwartzman at times seemed like polar opposites as personalities, they in fact shared a deep craving for public recognition. Schwartzman had something to prove. It was clear for all to see. Peterson's need to play the role of public-minded sage was more subtle, but no less profound. The personalities and ambitions of both, and the incongruity of their partnership, was never more apparent than in the Sunday New York Times on September 16, 1990. By a poetic coincidence of newspaper scheduling, both men occupied prominent spots in that issue. On the op-ed page, Peterson weighed in with an earnest 1,400-word piece, calling on Congress to enact a multi-year deficit reduction program, the federal deficit having become an obsession with him. In a glossy men's fashion of the Times insert, meanwhile, Blackstone CEO was on display in a three-quarter page photo, modeling a $1,300 Allen Flusser wool suit with matching silk jacquard tie. To some people's eyes, Schwartzman's trousers, bunched at the shoes, accentuated his shortness. Peterson found Schwartzman's Manhattan dandy act so achingly funny that the next day at 345 Park Avenue, he pinned up Schwartzman's fashion shot in his office to draw laughs from those who dropped by. "Pete thought it was hilarious," says a former Blackstone partner. Steve was really pissed off. To those who knew Peterson, it was just another example of his irrepressible, impish reflex to tease those around him. He could be merciless, but for the frequently remote Peterson, it was also a form of affection, a bonding ritual. Schwartzman, who could be thin-skinned, usually took Peterson's taunts in stride, and gave as good as he got. In that era, Steve and Pete were very close, says Jonathan Colby, a partner at Carlyle, who worked at Blackstone in the early 1990s. Each knew what the other was thinking. It was like they communicated telepathically. Over time, however, there were growing strains, and their camaraderie faded. Pinpointing the source is hard. But some trace it to the time around 1992, when Peterson's slice of the profits was reduced. From the beginning, he and Schwartzman had had sole voting control over the buyout and M&A businesses, and had an equal share in the profits, then about 30% each. As new partners arrived, they had each been given slices of what the firm made, which diluted Peterson's and Schwartzman's portions equally. That year, the two founders agreed that henceforth, as new partners joined, Peterson would cede more of his share to them. Thus, over time, his cut of the bottom line would steadily drop. By then, there was no dispute that Schwartzman was pulling more weight at the firm. Even so, the financial realignment marked the end of their equal partnership and an acknowledgement of Schwartzman's primacy at the enterprise they'd created and built together. I felt it was fair that our shares would be diluted as we added new partners, but my shares should be diluted somewhat more than his. That is what we did, and I fully agreed it was fair, Peterson says. His career as a savant and writer was eating up much of his time, and he'd long ago ceded the top managerial role to his younger co-founder. What's more, his cut would remain substantial, within 5 points of Schwartzman's, and would remain well above any other partner's. The profit split was not what pushed the men apart, says an investment banker who is a friend of Peterson's, but rather values and style. With Pete, it wasn't the money. Money didn't matter to Pete the way it did to Steve, says the banker, who describes Peterson's material cravings as modest, certainly by Schwartzman's standards. What eventually got to Pete was Steve's lifestyle, his flashing his wealth, his drawing attention to himself. That's not what Pete is about. Pete doesn't believe the point of making money is to let everyone know you made it, says a second person who knows them both well. Steve doesn't have a problem with that. Though to this day, both tout their relationship as the longest-lasting partnership on Wall Street. By the 2000s, their relations were frayed, and they carped about each other to friends. Schwartzman would grumble about Peterson still collecting millions but contributing little, while Peterson would snipe about Schwartzman's crass displays of wealth. There were other strains, too, at the top of an organization that shed partners faster than a dog sheds hair. In 1992, just 2 years after Schwartzman recruited him from First Boston for the buyout team, David Batten quit for a high-profile position at Lazard Frere, and Joe Robert, whom Batten had recruited in 1991 to buy distressed real estate in a joint venture with Blackstone, defected to Goldman Sachs. Jurger Johnstone, an M&A honcho hired from Morgan Stanley in 1991, lasted less than 3 years. Even by Wall Street's easy-go standards, the revolving door at Blackstone whirled fast. Far more consequential than those losses were three others that gutted the leadership of Blackstone's core businesses, the departures of Henry Silverman, Roger Altman, and Larry Fink from 1991 to 1994. Silverman was the first out, and not because he had blundered. On the contrary, Silverman oozed competence. 6 years older than Schwartzman, he was shrewd, cool, and commanding, a master craftsman with an eagle eye for great deals. Schwartzman very much liked his style, and to this day talks admiringly of the way Silverman foresaw when he joined Blackstone that the Days Inn hotel chain would get in trouble, and that Blackstone would be able to buy it on the cheap. There was no doubt about Silverman's contributions at Blackstone, but Prudential Insurance, the anchor investor for Blackstone's first fund, had it in for Silverman over a deal from his days at Reliance Capital, the investment arm of financier Saul Steinberg's Reliance Insurance. In 1987, Prudential bought John Blair Communications, a television ad business from Telemundo, which was owned by Reliance Capital. Prudential grossly overpaid, and Blair began to founder not long after the purchase. Prudential later sued Reliance and Telemundo, claiming they had misrepresented Blair's condition. The suit was still active in 1991, when Prudential discovered that Silverman had resurfaced at Blackstone, and it urged Schwartzman and Peterson to boot him out. Prue felt it would be very difficult, as the lead investor in Blackstone, to be in litigation against one of the key managers of Blackstone's fund, says Gary Trabka, the Prudential executive who oversaw the insurer's investment in Blackstone's fund at the time. Schwartzman looked into the matter and concluded that Silverman was likely blameless, but he and Peterson felt they had no choice but to accede to their investor. Silverman didn't have to go far to find a new job, however. He simply went to work full-time as chairman and CEO of Hospitality Franchising Systems, the hotel system he had helped Blackstone buy the year before. Blackstone gave him a chunk of HFS stock and free rein to run the business. As severance packages go, this one was a doozy, for HFS went public in 1992, and over the next 15 years, Silverman transformed it into Cendant Corporation, a franchising empire that controlled top brands such as the real estate brokerages Coldwell Banker and Century 21, Avis and Budget Car Rentals, Wyndham Hotels, and the Travelport and Orbitz reservation systems. Prudential's Blair Communications suit was ultimately settled for about $20 million, according to Silverman. Roger Altman's departure wasn't as cut and dried. With Altman, the primary bones of contention were loyalty and money. Schwartzman had always held something of a grudge against Altman for fending off his and Peterson's entreaties to join Blackstone until it had finished raising its first fund. Altman had paid dearly for his dilly-dallying, receiving only about a 4% stake in the firm. He had quickly become a powerful revenue magnet for Blackstone, generating a wealth of M&A fees and fathering two of its more successful early buyouts, Transtar and Six Flags, and resented his lowly stake. The genesis of the schism between Roger and Steve and Pete is that Roger was really unhappy about his equity, says a former Blackstone partner. For years, Altman agitated for a bigger piece of the pie, and in 1991 or early 1992, Schwartzman and Peterson relented, elevating Altman's share to around 7%. The peace didn't last long. Altman, who had always been drawn to politics, had put his career at Lehman on hold to work for the Carter administration. Soon after his stake in Blackstone went up, he was working behind the scenes to help elect his friend and former Georgetown University classmate, Bill Clinton, president, which ate into the hours he gave Blackstone. Peterson, Altman's mentor at Lehman, was understanding about Altman's political involvements, remembers Austin Buettner, a former Blackstone partner and friend of Altman's. When I left Blackstone to do my thing in government, Pete was one of the first to congratulate me on the opportunity, he says. I'm sure he felt the same way for Roger. Schwartzman was less forgiving. Roger, right after the bump up in his equity, starts spending maybe one-third of his time on the campaign. Steve wasn't happy about it, one former partner says. Eventually, Schwartzman's personal life fueled his sense of pique. In 1990, his wife Ellen filed for divorce and began angling for a hefty settlement. This thing with Roger asking for more partnership points was going on while Steve thought he was losing half his net worth to Ellen, says a former Blackstone partner. Schwartzman would buttonhole partners and moan that Ellen wanted to dispossess him of 50% of his net worth, says another ex-colleague. He complained a lot about that. Because Schwartzman at the time was worth at least $100 million, Ellen Schwartzman presumably was asking for $50 million or more. The divorce steeled Schwartzman's resolve to safeguard his hard-earned fortune. He wasn't going to cede a fraction of his worth to a partner who then gave short shrift to Blackstone. There is no one who ever got a scintilla of equity in Blackstone who didn't feel like it was pulling teeth from Steve. He's not one of these people who graciously hands out equity, the same former partner says. In January 1993, when Altman took a job as Deputy Treasury Secretary in the new Clinton administration, he locked horns again with Schwartzman and Peterson over money. The issue this time was Altman's potentially valuable 3% stake in Blackstone Financial Management, the fast-growing fixed-income venture that Larry Fink led. Altman fought tenaciously to hang on to his share of BFM, But Blackstone's founder said no because of the potential conflict of interest. For a high-level Treasury Department official to own a sizable piece of a firm that traded Treasury securities would flunk just about any smell test. Altman's exit from Washington in 1994 was even bumpier. That August, he resigned under pressure over his handling of congressional inquiries into Whitewater, a financial and political scandal that grew out of a dubious 1980s Arkansas land deal involving Bill and Hillary Clinton. Though the Clintons were never prosecuted for their roles in the affair, other Whitewater figures were convicted of fraud. When Altman returned to New York, says a friend, he fully expected Schwartzman and Peterson to cast aside bygones and ask him to rejoin the firm, but the invitation was never extended. Altman went on to start an M&A private equity boutique of his own, Evercore Partners, which swiftly established itself as a top deal advisor. That he wasn't asked back had nothing to do with Whitewater, a former partner says. It had everything to do with what had gone on before. Altman's absence left a gaping hole in Blackstone's M&A operation, one that Peterson's diminishing involvement made wider. Other parts of the business grew by leaps and bounds after 1992, but the M&A group did not. Its inability to keep pace with the explosive growth in Bruce Wasserstein's M&A business exasperated Schwartzman, even though he had left Wasserstein behind in the dust in the leveraged buyout arena. Significant as the loss of Altman was, the departure that hurt most on the bottom line was Larry Fink's. By early 1992, BFM's assets under management had rocketed to $8.1 billion, and it was earning $13 million a year after taxes. It was doing so well that in mid-1992, Fink and Blackstone laid plans to raise outside capital through an IPO. At the time, Fink, Ralph Schlosstein, and other senior BFM managers jointly owned 45% of the business through a partnership, while Blackstone Group and its partners owned another 35.3%. Fink and Schlosstein individually owned much of the rest. But Fink and Schwartzman soon were at loggerheads over money. In order to corral top-notch talent, Fink insisted that he be able to award new hires a stake in BFM, the same lure Schwartzman had used to bring Fink under the Blackstone roof. Schwartzman and BFM's executives had been doing just that, steadily handing over part of their own stakes as the business added senior staff. But after Blackstone's stake slipped to around 35%, Schwartzman drew the line, telling Fink the parent company wouldn't drop its stake further. Some trace Schwartzman's intransigence to his divorce battle. "He was obsessed about it," says one colleague from the time. "When money is as important to you as it is to Steve, and you think you're going to lose 50% of your savings, you become more difficult." At an impasse, Schwartzman found himself negotiating a second divorce between Blackstone and Fink's group. Convinced that Blackstone had become a drag on his grand designs, Fink shelved his plans for an IPO and demanded the outright sale of his unit. Schwartzman, despite his strong initial resistance, finally relented. In June 1994, the business, which in the interim had adopted the name BlackRock Financial Management, had seen its assets climb to $23 billion, was sold to PNC Bank Corporation of Pittsburgh for $240 million. Blackstone's partners made out well, pocketing upward of $80 million in cash, in addition to about $30 million in dividends they'd collected from BFM over the previous 6 years. Schwartzman personally banked more than $25 million, enough to subsidize most, if not all, of his split from Ellen. Though the size of the divorce settlement was never disclosed, Business Week put it above $20 million. BlackRock went on to surpass Fink's headiest dreams. Over the next dozen years, it grew into an investment empire comprising $1.2 trillion of assets, mostly fixed income and real estate securities, reshuffled its ownership, and went public in 2006. By 2010, BlackRock was the world's biggest publicly traded money manager, twice as big as its nearest rival, with $3.2 trillion in assets and 8,500 employees in 24 countries. Fink emerged as a Wall Street prince on a par with Schwarzman and became an advisor to the Obama administration on ways to resuscitate the U.S. economy. Schwarzman would later freely admit he'd sold BlackRock too soon. Though he personally earned a tidy sum on the sale to PNC, if Schwarzman had held on to even 3% of BlackRock, less than a third of his ownership stake when BlackRock was sold to PNC, he'd have been about $1.3 billion richer by 2010. After Henry Silverman's forced departure, Blackstone's complement of LBO specialists was skeletally thin. It now consisted of a cadre of bright young strivers and a single middle-aged luminary, the brainy and difficult David Stockman. A high-octane personality by nature, Stockman kept his mind in overdrive by consuming more caffeine and nicotine than a French existentialist. He was a two-fister, alternately guzzling coffee from a mug in one hand and taking deep drags from a cigarette in the other. He later quit smoking, but his caffeine habit remained. Blackstone partner Chin Chu, then a junior staffer, recalls flying with Stockman to Kokomo, Indiana, 50 miles north of Indianapolis, to visit the headquarters of Haynes International, a machinery maker Blackstone owned. When they arrived and got in their rented car, Stockman started driving in the wrong direction. When Chu asked where they were going, Stockman replied, "There's not a Starbucks until Indianapolis." 2 hours and a 100-mile round trip to the state capital later, they arrived at Haynes. Stockman's febrile temperament alternately entertained and bemused his associates, who marveled at his mind's capacity to soak up oceans of data. Yet by the early 1990s, it was evident that the Reagan administration whiz kid was an unreliable judge of deals. Yes, he'd been dead right about Edgecombe, warning Schwarzman in advance of that buyout's perils. But he also had delivered similarly gloomy judgments on other Blackstone investments that later performed well, including Transtar, Days Inn, and Six Flags. Meanwhile, his Collins and Aikman, formerly Wicks investment, was struggling. It wasn't just that he was sometimes wrong. His high-handed dismissals of his fellow partners' deals left him with few friends. At an investment committee meeting in 1991, Stockman arrived armed with two assistants, graphs and spreadsheets, prepared to do battle over a proposed $81 million equity investment in Six Flags, an amusement park operator that had fallen on hard times under its previous owner, Westray Capital. Blackstone and Time Warner, its corporate partner in the investment, had worked up a plan to boost TV advertising using Time Warner's popular Looney Tunes cartoon characters, which they believed would lure kids back to the parks and resuscitate the business. Everyone involved in the deal was convinced that Six Flags could be turned around. Time Warner, Roger Altman, who had spotted the opportunity and recruited Bob Pittman, a co-founder of MTV and a media marketing guru, to manage Six Flags, Henry Silverman, the deal's overseer, and Howard Lipson, who had helped Silverman vet the proposal. Stockman begged to differ. David came to the meeting with a fully baked counter-argument to the plan, a person at the meeting says. Stockman produced a graph showing that leisure spending by Americans had been rising as a percentage of economic activity and insisted that it inevitably would drop back to the historic norm. He also had an analysis of the cost of adding exciting new attractions, the need to top yourself, the thrill factor, which he said was going up, so capital spending would be a problem. This person says, I think your attendance projections are too optimistic and your capital spending assumptions are too light, Stockman asserted. In fact, the transaction had been tailored to protect Blackstone in the event of just such problems. Blackstone had agreed that Time Warner would get a lopsided share of the profits if the company performed exceptionally well. In exchange, Blackstone got what amounted to a guarantee that it would earn a minimum return of 25% so long as cash flows grew modestly. When Stockman was finished and it was Howard Lipson's turn to speak, he told Stockman, You know, even if all your assumptions are right and we plug your attendance and capital spending figures into our model, we still get a 23% return. Flustered, Stockman stared at Lipson's spreadsheet and retorted, Well, that's just because of the way you structured it. Exactly, said Lipson. Silverman, Altman, and Lipson won the argument, and in the coming months the investment played out exactly as they'd hoped. In December 1992, a year after the $760 million buyout, Time Warner exercised its option to buy out Blackstone's stake in the resurgent company for $104 million. Stockman's dyspeptic prophecy notwithstanding, Blackstone raked in a 27% return. Because of his spotty record, Stockman never earned Schwartzman's unconditional trust, nor did he ascend to the role of Schwartzman's chief deputy, which Silverman effectively had occupied until he left in 1991, a role to which Stockman's fame, experience, and age might otherwise have entitled him. Instead, that function gradually passed to a much younger man, who joined Blackstone from Shearson Lehman in 1987 as a lowly vice president. James Mossman was 29 years old in 1988 when he untangled the financial complexities of Transtar, USX's short-line railroad, and persuaded his superiors to make the investment that put Blackstone on the map. The next year, he solidified his status as a rising star with brilliant financial modeling work and with his hard-bitten style while negotiating key elements of the CNW buyout. No one was more enamored of him than Schwartzman. James's IQ was off the charts, says Blackstone partner J. Tomlinson Hill III, who joined Blackstone in 1993. Away from the office, the University of Toronto graduate got his intellectual kicks, dabbling in astrophysics and mathematical esoterica, like string theory. A late 1987 photograph in a Blackstone newspaper ad shows a grinning Mossman in dark framed glasses, standing aside a group of colleagues, a ringer for Clark Kent, minus the neck muscles. But unlike Superman's alter ego, Mossman was anything but fumbling and meek. His primary social deficiency, some viewed it as a strength, was his unvarnished candor. If he thought an idea was flawed or dim-witted, he'd say so. James saw the world in black and white, says Kenneth Whitney, a longtime Blackstone partner. Mossman's personality was similarly split, Whitney says. He had a great sense of humor, but as soon as he focused on something, he turned very serious. It was like Jekyll and Hyde. He had an obsessive-compulsive side, sometimes going 2 or 3 days without sleep when immersed in a deal. Says Whitney, he had the kind of personality that only had one speed, full speed ahead. Inside 345 Park Avenue, verbal clashes between the equally headstrong Mossman and Stockman drew crowds. People would show up at investment committee meetings to see David and James debate, says partner Chin Chu. It was intense. When Stockman was on the defensive, one could almost see steam blowing out of his ears. A leg bobbed rapidly up and down. His speech raced. His body trembled. Mossman kept his cool throughout, delivering logically elegant counter-thrusts. James was professorial, but he could drive a point home, says Chu. He could take a deck of analysis and zero in on the top three issues within minutes. That's an innate ability. By contrast, Stockman, the data point and treadline junkie, could spout decades of actuarial statistics for a pension plan or reams of figures on oil refining capacity, but often lost the forest for the trees, his former colleagues say. 3 years after his arrival, Mossman became a partner, and he evolved into the firm's de facto chief investment officer, the point man through whom all deals had to flow. In that role, he distanced himself entirely from the messy particulars and distractions of deal-making. Aside from Transtar and CNW, he never involved himself in sourcing or spearheading buyouts. At most, he occasionally rigged up an ingenious asset-backed financing scheme or the like. He never met with the management of a prospective portfolio company, never spoke with limited partners. Instead, he holed up in his office, where he vetted his partners' investment proposals on paper. It was a peculiar modus operandi for a chief investment officer, but it served a function in the organization, keeping Mossman at an emotional distance from the pitches he received and helping to keep the firm from succumbing to the momentum the investment process can take on when people have invested weeks or months probing a company. He doesn't have deal fever, says Simon Lonergan, who worked at Blackstone from 1996 to 2004. Doing nothing is as good as doing something in James's mind. He was an analytically rigorous guy, very disciplined. Even though Schwartzman made the final call on investments, he seldom second-guessed his young adjutant. As a result, Mossman became the behind-the-scenes arbiter of which deals got done, and his cerebral approach had a quiet but profound impact on Blackstone's investment agenda over the rest of the 90s and into the next decade. Chapter 11. Hanging Out New Shingles. While the buyout business was in suspended animation during the downturn of the early 1990s, Schwartzman set out to nurture new business lines more suited to a period of tumbling markets and a drought of leverage. In May 1991, he poached a six-member crew of debt restructuring specialists from Chemical Bank, led by Arthur Newman, an ace in the field. The move paid off quickly as assignments poured in from America West Airlines, R.H. Macy & Company, steelmaker LTV Corporation, and other bankrupt corporations needing advice on reorganizing their finances. In time, Blackstone's restructuring advisory group would expand to 44 professionals and would draw some of the most challenging restructurings in the early 2000s, and again at the end of that decade. Schwartzman had set out to establish a real estate investment arm, too, as the Resolution Trust Corporation, the federal agency charged with cleaning up the S&L mess, prepared to unload thousands of properties and distressed loans the government had taken over from failed savings and loans. The quick departure of Joe Robert in 1992 had set back that plan, but Schwartzman began looking for a replacement and soon found his way to John Schreiber, 46, who had retired from his job as head of acquisitions for JMB Realty Corporation, a Chicago-based real estate empire that specialized in syndicated real estate investments, a forerunner to today's multi-billion-dollar real estate private equity industry. JMB had pioneered the kind of real estate private equity Schwartzman had in mind, buying properties on the cheap or in need of upgrading and selling them a few years later. Schwartzman first contacted Schreiber for advice on whom he might hire, but after talking with other property investors and bankers, he called Schreiber back in the summer of 1992 and tried to woo Schreiber for the position. "I told him I had no interest," Schreiber says. Schreiber had promised his wife he wouldn't go back to work full-time. He was sick of managing, and there was no way he was moving to New York. But Schwartzman pressed him and pressed him. Finally, Schreiber's wife suggested that he make what seemed to both husband and wife to be ridiculous demands. He told Schwartzman he'd be willing to consult and help Schwartzman recruit a hands-on management team in exchange for an ownership stake, but he would work just 40 days a year and from Chicago. To the Schreiber's amazement, Schwartzman agreed. The business was structured along the lines of Blackstone Financial Management, Larry Fink's fixed income operation. Blackstone owned 80% and Schreiber 20%, but Blackstone agreed to hand off part of its stake to managers as they were hired, so that the business eventually would be owned 50-50 by its executives and Blackstone. Schreiber would remain, in his words, third base coach. By late 1992, JMB Realty, which had once boasted $24 billion in assets, was in trouble, as some of the highly leveraged deals it had engineered in the good times were unwinding, and many of its executives were looking for jobs. Schreiber targeted one of them, Barry Sternlicht, to head up the new business at Blackstone. "We had basically agreed on terms to bring Barry and his group," Schreiber says, "but at the last minute he changed his mind." Sternlicht went on to form Starwood Capital, his own property investment firm. In his place, Schreiber in 1993 recruited Thomas Salak, who had worked at Trammell Crowe Company, another big property firm, and a year later hired another JMB alumnus, John Kukrel, to be his field commanders. Schwartzman reckoned there was a windfall to be made in distressed real estate, as the property boom of the 80s came to a harsh end. Developers and lenders were struggling in the aftermath, and the government was shoveling billions of dollars of savings and loan property out the door to anyone who could make a solid bid. The problem was that Blackstone had scant capital to invest in such deals. The firm tried in 1991 to persuade the investors in Blackstone's first fund to plow up to $400 million, close to half the fund, into properties being auctioned by Resolution Trust. But because many of the limited partners were U.S. and Japanese institutions already freighted with troubled real estate, they nixed the idea. With a new team on board, Blackstone set out to raise hundreds of millions of dollars for a dedicated real estate fund. In late 1993, Schreiber clinched his first trophy deal. Edward J. DeBartolo Corporation, which owned stakes in 57 regional malls, the Ralph supermarket chain, and numerous parcels of land, had fallen on hard times, and DeBartolo's lenders were eager to rid their books of its debt. Through his long-standing ties to the First National Bank of Chicago, Schreiber arranged to buy $196 million of secured debt from the bank for 56 cents on the dollar. Because DeBartolo owned a mix of corporate assets and real estate, Blackstone could tap its LBO fund. The deal turned into a winner. When a company defaults on its debt, creditors can often swap the debt they hold for equity when the company restructures. In April 1994, Blackstone did just that, and in 1996, it cashed out, more than doubling its $109 million investment. Schreiber's next major deal involved a failed JMB Realty investment he knew all too well, Cadillac Fairview. The Canadian shopping mall owner had been JMB's crown jewel, owning Toronto's Eaton Center and Toronto Dominion Center and the Pacific Center in Vancouver. Schreiber had helped engineer JMB's $5.1 billion buyout of Cadillac Fairview, which was the largest real estate deal of the 1980s. But in 1991, with the economy in the dumps, the company was buckling under its debt. Cadillac Fairview's financial downfall, more than any other event, triggered JMB's demise. Now Schreiber would have a chance to try his hand at vulture investing. Just as Leon Black had established Apollo's reputation by picking up the broken remnants of deals he had fathered when he worked at Drexel, Schreiber would use his knowledge of Cadillac Fairview to make money from its restructuring. With the confidence that comes from knowing the target, in February 1995, Blackstone's real estate team swooped down and bid off a $10 million morsel of Cadillac Fairview's bank debt. It ultimately was angling for equity in the restructured company. By this time, Schreiber's group was flush with money, having stockpiled $330 million in commitments in 1994 for the real estate investment fund. And later in 1995, it joined up with the giant Ontario Teachers Pension Plan Board and pushed through a bailout plan for Cadillac Fairview that Schreiber had taken a hand in crafting. In exchange for injecting $200 million, the two acquired a combined 32% stake. Goldman Sachs, the largest creditor, swapped its bank loans for 22%. 2 years later, Cadillac Fairview went public. The deleveraged company thrived, and when Blackstone later cashed out, it made a $73 million profit on its $65.5 million investment. JMB had blazed the trail for real estate private equity long before Blackstone, but Blackstone was the first large corporate LBO specialist in America to launch a real estate venture, and it was the only one that developed into a top-tier player. Apollo and the Carlyle Group launched their own units in 1993, but Apollo Real Estate Advisors eventually split from Leon Black and renamed itself, and Carlyle's property business remained relatively small. The hiring of Schreiber, Salak, and Kukral drew little attention at the time. Much more ballyhooed was the hiring of J. Tomlinson, Tom Hill III, an old friend and fellow partner of Peterson's and Schwartzman's at Lehman. Hill was a steely M&A gladiator who'd been in the thick of some of the most memorable hostile takeover battles of the 1980s, siding with Federated Department Stores in its defense against Robert Campo and working with Ross Johnson, the CEO of RJR Nabisco, in the fight for control there. Hill had also been an architect of some of the most iconic friendly mergers of the age, Bendix Corporation's $1.8 billion merger with Allied Corporation in 1983, American Stores' $2.5 billion takeover of Lucky Stores in 1988, and Time Incorporated's $14 billion merger with Warner Communications in 1989. He dressed the part to perfection, from his back-combed coif to his impeccably tailored Paul Stewart suits and tasseled loafers. Rumor had it that Gordon Gekko, in the movie Wall Street, was styled after Tom Hill. In 1993, Hill was ousted as Lehman's co-CEO, and Blackstone soon tapped him to co-head M&A and assume Roger Altman's mantle as a brand-name rainmaker. From the moment Altman left, Schwartzman and Peterson had searched doggedly for a worthy replacement. Schwartzman remarked when Blackstone hired Hill, "Tom fills that bill," he said. The timing seemed propitious. Merger activity, which bottomed out in 1991 and 1992, was rebounding, nearly tripling from 1992 to 1995, and Hill spoke boldly of capitalizing on the upturn. Blackstone hoped it might even steal business from M&A powerhouses such as Goldman and Merrill Lynch. There was little doubt Hill would transform M&A into a stout fourth leg of Blackstone's business platform. But it wasn't to be. Though a new merger wave was taking off, Hill and the group's other co-head, Michael Hoffman, never met Schwartzman's lofty expectations. Hill and Hoffman weren't wholly to blame. As the regulatory barriers between commercial banks and investment banks came down, investment banks became free to make commercial loans, and commercial banks moved into the traditional preserve of the investment banks, advising on mergers and capital.